everybody. This is Stacy Harp, president of Active Christian Media, and I want to thank you for joining us today for another Active Christian Media podcast. You know, today we are going to be talking to Bob Hamer, who is the author of this brand new book called The Last Undercover, The True Story of an FBI Agent's Dangerous Dance with Evil. This is where I want to go. Dun, dun, dun! Anyway, it's probably not that dramatic. Well, actually it is. I've been reading the book, and fortunate enough, I have Bob here on the line, you know, and he's a former FBI agent. And this book, I have to tell you, is riveting. It's fun to read, and it's also... My phone is ringing. It's also one of these books that makes you think and also, like, makes you root for the good guy. So I'm really happy to have you here, Bob, to talk about it. And welcome to the show.
Thanks, Stacy. I appreciate you having me on.
Oh, no problemo. I'm glad to have you on because this book is so cool. And it's your life. It's not even a fake story. Well.
Yeah, it's all true. It's all my life. Some of it, I mean, I've kind of given you some of the warts and the blemishes, part of my undercover assignments. But I wanted to make it interesting because I wanted to get the message out, particularly about the NAMBLA investigation, the North American Man-Boy Love Association.
Yeah, and you know what? That's actually what drew me to the book because I don't like NAMBLA. And I know people who have been members. Well, I don't know them personally, but they're online. And, you know, so I was totally intrigued. Except this book isn't just about your bust with NAMBLA. It's also about some other really interesting undercover stuff that you did. But before we get into that, what I want to do is I want to just ask you, you know, to explain to the audience a little bit about your background and how you got into the FBI. Because I know that... well, you applied to the CIA and you didn't quite make it in there, did you?
No, I was in the, I actually graduated from college, then I went to law school and was a licensed attorney, joined the Marine Corps. I actually joined the Marine Corps while I was in college and then was commissioned as a second lieutenant in the Marine Corps. They were looking for attorneys. They said, look, if you go to law school, we'll allow you to go to law school. And then when you come out of law school, you can practice in the Marine Corps as a judge advocate. So I did that. I spent 4 years as a judge advocate. I enjoyed the Marines, but I actually hated practicing law. I did not enjoy the courtroom at all. It was always, came down to procedural issues. Never was a whodunit as you see on television. You know, we didn't have that big moment where you get the supposedly innocent person confessing on the stand. It was always... whether the search was legal, whether the confession is admissible. And I was really looking for something more. So as I was just about to complete my Marine Corps obligation, I started looking around and I applied to both the CIA and the FBI. Both of them, well, the FBI said they were having a one-year hiring freeze, and the CIA was a fascinating employment experience, but essentially it came down to, at the very end, they didn't like attorneys. I'd never really worked overseas, and I scored a 0 on their personality test. And they were, on a scale of 0 to 10, they were looking for 3s and 4s, and the psychologist said he'd never seen a 0. So we joke about that now. I think maybe I'm up to maybe a 0.5 or even a 1 on a personality scale. But it worked out well because then, even though I do talk about it in the book, even though the FBI was on a hiring freeze, it truly, as an answer to prayer, an opening came up right as I was about to leave the Marine Corps. And I left the Marine Corps in August and joined the FBI in September. So I believed from the very beginning I was in the FBI for a reason.
Yeah, well, that is cool. You know, and don't ever, I mean, of course, reading your book, we know you have personality, that's for sure. Now the other thing I wanted to have you open up with too is just share a little bit about, I read in the front of the book here that you actually had a hard time getting this thing published. Tell us a little bit about what that was like for you, because I honestly can't believe that a publisher would turn this down.
Yeah, no, it was very difficult. I have a great agent, Bucky Rosenbaum. He was on staff at Saddleback Church in Orange County, California, and was actually, essentially, he was the agent for Rick Warren in all of the Purpose Driven Life series. So he'd been in the publishing business for 30 years. He was going out on his own as to start his own literary agency. I was actually his first client, and I met him at my brother's Christmas party. He was telling me about his experiences in the publishing world, and I started talking to him about the FBI and how what I really wanted to do was expose NAMBLA and this underground network of pedophiles. And he said, you know, I think that would be very interesting. I'd be fascinated by it. Why don't you start writing? So I wrote. It only took me about 3 months, 3 or 4 months, and I'd actually written about 85,000 words.
Wow.
So when I next met with him, we sat down. He read it. He liked what he read. He said, yes, let's send this out. He said, I believe that we're going to find a publisher very easily. I mean, when you look at it, Law & Order SVU is the top-rated show on NBC. Chris Hansen's Dateline Predators series, or the Catch a Predator series, gets about 10 million viewers. So it's like, this is almost a no-brainer. You've got an undercover FBI agent telling a true story about his infiltration of a group of pedophiles. It just seems like everyone would jump on board. And it turned out that some publishers, sort of the more conservative publishing houses, we didn't out any major political cronies, so they weren't interested in the book. Some people viewed this as possibly a gay-bashing book, which it certainly is not. Sort of the Christian and family media thought it was too icky to talk about NAMBLA. So we really did have a difficult time. I was fortunate in that two of the publishers, and I'll go ahead and name them, Regnery, Margie Ross at Regnery, and Jed Donahue at Crown Forum, both said that they might be interested in the book if I throw in more undercover stories. They just didn't want to an entire book on pedophiles. So I was reluctant at first to do that. I really didn't write the book to pound my chest and say what a cool guy I was because I worked undercover for the FBI. I was more interested in getting out this, exposing this boy lover agenda. But the more I thought about it, it made sense because had I not had these other experiences, I don't think I would have been successful posing as a pedophile. And had this been my first undercover assignment, I probably wouldn't have done any more undercover assignments because it was too psychologically and emotionally wrenching for me. So it made sense that without this preparation, my previous undercover preparation, I wouldn't have been successful in the NAMBLA investigation. So I threw in a dozen other stories. We went back to both Regnery and Crown Forum, and they said, no, it's still not the book we wanted. But we did go back to Gary Tereshita, who was at Center Street Press, which is a division of the Hachette Book Group. And they had previously rejected the book. And once he saw the new format and the added stories, he got it. He said, oh, yeah, you know what? This will work. I understand what you're trying to do. And he was great. So we were able to find a publisher. But it was not easy. I joke that it's been like the gestation period of an elephant without the morning sickness.
Well, you know, I can tell you reading the book, you know, even though my main purpose in wanting to read it is because of the NAMBLA thing, I can tell you having read it, or at least just to be honest with my listeners, it's a 350-page book, and I'm only up to 150, so I'm halfway through it. But I, you know, it was hard to put down last night when I had to go to bed, but my eyes were so tired. But here's the thing. I can tell you that because of the other stories in it, it kind of takes some of the anger that I have felt reading about the NAMBLA thing. It gives me time to calm down a little bit, you know, before I can get back into that story. Because some of your other escapades were kind of funny.
No, I agree. And I mean, you know, kids, don't try this at home. I mean, I'm dealing with professionals here in terms of the publishers. And they knew what the reading audience, or, you know, what readers wanted. And they were absolutely right. And it's a much better book now than what it was when I was just trying to peddle the NAMBLA investigation. And so I'm glad I did it. If nothing else, at least my grandkids will know, you know, the stuff that I did. And so that's worked out well. And I've actually been fortunate to talk to some other
FBI
undercover agents who are younger. And, you know, they've enjoyed the book, and it's given them some good ideas just in some of their approaches to undercover investigations. So I've served a dual purpose.
Yeah, well, you know, everybody, let me just remind you, I know you already heard this, but we're talking to Bob Hamer, who is the author of The Last Undercover. You have to get this book, guys. You really do. You have to get it. We'll tell you how in a little bit. But I want you to talk a little bit about your initial reaction when you actually went in to meet at the NAMBLA conference. And then specifically the part that really impacted me was the Toys R Us part. When I read that, I was like, you know, I had never thought about that. But I think it was to me, that just that initial opening was very poignant. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I had joined the organization in 2001, and we were actually targeting a travel agent that operated out of Hollywood, California, and he actually catered to what is called boy lovers, or, you know, men who are sexually attracted to boys. So we were targeting him. I joined NAMBLA thinking that it would sort of establish my bona fides within this travel agency and would help us in that investigation. So I got involved in NAMBLA through that. I sent in my $35. They sent me back a letter, the actual letter is published in the book, so you can see it in the book. But I was still not having face-to-face meetings with NAMBLA members. I had tried to get they have an annual conference, or at least they did until our investigation. And I tried to get invited to their annual conference, and I was told, no, you haven't been a member long enough. Essentially, you haven't been vetted. We don't know who you are, and you have to be a member for 3 years and sort of go through our vetting process, which they never quite explained what it was. So I just assumed, well, whatever. I continued. I was involved in their pen pal program. I was corresponding with NAMBLA members who were in prison. And lo and behold, I received an invitation to the New York conference. So this was going to be my first face-to-face encounter with NAMBLA members. I'd been a member for a little over a year. It turned out that because I was active in the pen pal program, I'd actually submitted a couple articles to be published in their magazine, which is called the Bulletin. So they realized that, okay, I must be a fairly dedicated member. I had cleared their unofficial vetting process. So I received this invitation. But again, I didn't know really what to look for, what to expect. I'd seen a few grainy photographs of a few members, but it wasn't like the FBI had an intelligence file on NAMBLA. In fact, it would be illegal to keep an intelligence file on NAMBLA because technically it's a First Amendment protected organization. Now, I would like to argue that with constitutional lawyers, but in terms of the FBI, it wasn't the type of organization in which we keep a running tally of everyone who's a member. So my first encounter was at New York, and we met at Grand Central Station. This organization is so secret that even their membership conference, they wouldn't tell you where it was going to be held. We knew it was in New York City. We knew on Friday night when we got there and we met in the lower concourse of Grand Central Station that they were going to provide us directions to where the membership conference was actually going to be held. So it's all this super secret stuff. I mean, you know, this isn't the Kiwanis or the Optimist Club or the Knights of Columbus or something. I mean, this group, you didn't even have to use your real name when you were dealing with other members. So I know I'm supposed to meet them at 6:30. I walk down the ramp. If any of your listeners have been to Grand Central Station, I was up on the upper concourse. I walked down the ramp to the lower concourse, and there they were, right in the middle of the lower concourse. My first reaction was, Central Casting, send me some perverts. I mean, these guys looked like who you would want if you were casting a pedophile movie. But then when I got to look at them a little more carefully, they didn't all look like, you know, they'd be hanging out in public parks with a trench coat or something like that. I mean, some of them looked extremely normal. And I think that's what scared me the most was this wasn't someone that you could readily identify as being a pedophile. Well, what happened was that night, as part of this sort of socialization process, we took a tour of Times Square. And about half of us that met, there were maybe 25 that night that met, well, about half of us decided to take this tour of Times Square that Peter Melzer, who was essentially one of the head, or like the CFO, I guess, or the CEO of NAMBLA, he was the one that was going to take us on this walking tour of Times Square. So we began walking. It's where I first met Jeff DeVore, who's an ordained minister and slash chiropractor that worked in a church in Orange County, California.
Oh, no, it's so scary.
And so we started talking, and I was talking to some of the others. Well, as we're walking through Times Square, and Peter is pointing out the different little tourist attractions, I can actually sense excitement on the part of some of the members. I mean, some of them started giggling and were getting excited. I couldn't figure out what was going on, and all of a sudden we come to the Toys R Us, and these men, grown men, I mean, in their 50s and 60s, literally ran to the railing. And if your listeners have ever been there, inside the Toys R Us at Times Square, there's a 60-foot indoor Ferris wheel, and it actually spans three stories. So we came in at like the second level, and these men then hung out at the railing and talked about the boys that were going around riding in the Ferris wheel and making extremely sexually suggestive comments about what they would like to do to these boys. And it got me there. I mean, it grabbed me, because I had been corresponding with all these members in prison who I just thought, thank goodness these guys are in jail. I mean, they're where they belong to be, where they belong there, and that's where they should be. And so, you know, society, the justice system has worked because these men are incarcerated. Well, I found out that, you know, the guys I was dealing with weren't incarcerated, and they should have been. And what they were saying at that railing so disgusted me. I'm not sure, you know, if I were to do that today and hear these men, I might have thrown them off the railing, you know, because then I was undercover, and it kind of ruined our investigation. But it struck me that here are these parents that are bringing their children to what they assume to be a safe place, a safe haven, and they're really just, they were providing for these perverts just an opportunity to view these, you know, view their children as sexual objects. And I think that's what really set me off. Not that I wasn't already attuned to how corrupt and how evil this organization was, but once that night is what really, I think, fired my emotions about this whole investigation. Listening to these men at the railing at the Toys R Us.
Yeah, you know, when I read that, I thought, you know, when I read your reaction about how you wanted to throw him over the edge, I thought, I really like this guy. And I thought, but here's the other thing that's kind of, it's just so fascinating to me. And first of all, before I forget, I want you to know, my friend, listener, that I do have a couple of these books to give away. I've been given a couple of review copies. And so if you email me at stacyharp@gmail.com, STACYHARP as in Peter, @gmail.com, I'd be happy to send you a copy if I have any left by the time you email me. The thing, though, that cracks me up about this whole thing is that, number one, there's only a $35 fee to join. Number two, you talk later about how you were on the committee to write a pamphlet, and nobody really gave a rip about it. And all of these issues with them having to do with, you know, changing the age of consent law, they haven't done any of that. And then the most ironic part to me, and I find it the most humorous, well, actually, there's more than one humorous part, but this part, the whole pen pal program in jail. I mean, you would, a logical person would think, duh. I mean, if NAMBLA has a pen pal program for people who are in jail, what the heck does that tell you about how legitimate this place is? I just thought the irony of it all. But then the other thing is, the thing that cracked me up too is later in the book, you're talking about how you were listening to these two guys have a conversation about whether or not there's going to be somebody who infiltrated their meetings and how Peter was so good at screening people. And, you know, you're sitting there probably trying not to laugh too hard because here you are inside and you know, you passed the rigorous screening that they had. So I just thought that was funny.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure that, you know, I probably had that pregnant glow on my face when they were talking about how the only reason they came was because they know how carefully Peter screened all those that were invited. So the one guy said, you know, only a very, essentially an accomplished actor would be able to fool Peter. So I thought, well, I guess I'm better than I thought I was. So.
Yeah, well, you know, and then, you know, I was just, it's just very cool. And then here's the other thing, everybody, you know, Bob has also done some other undercover stuff that he weaves in through here. And one of the things that you covered was, and there's so much, just so you know, and we're not going to have a lot of time to cover everything, but one of the stories that really touched me is how you were setting up a time to get a drug deal, to do a drug deal, and it kept getting put off, and finally you said, you know what, I'm taking my kid to the baseball game. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, anytime you do a drug deal, especially when you're talking about a large amount of money, you're going to have a pretty sizable cover team. So that's always nerve-wracking for an undercover agent because you're always afraid that it's going to be some other surveillance agent that blows it because he looks too much like a cop or he smells like a cop or he does something stupid that the bad guys recognize. And we had set up a fairly large-scale cocaine transaction with a restaurant owner in Beverly Hills, California. And the first day, it didn't work out because the load car broke down on the LA freeway system, and so the supplier wasn't able to get to the restaurant with the cocaine. Well, the second day, I actually had tickets to the Angels baseball game, two seats right behind the dugout, and I promised my son I was going to take him to the ball game. And we lived essentially 50 miles from the office, and then our house was another 100 miles to the Anaheim baseball stadium. So I had 150 miles that I had to cover. Well, when it got put off the first day and it was going to happen on the next day, I told the guy, look, I'll be here at noon. If you don't have the drugs here by 1:30, I'm leaving because I don't mess with this. At the time, I was posing as a screenwriter in Hollywood, and I was telling him that I had to, I was missing meetings to try to put together this drug deal, and he was messing me up because I could only come during my lunch hour and all of that. So it fit well with this whole scenario. So the next day, I get there at noon. I think I've got like $400,000 in a briefcase to purchase all these drugs. And at about 1:20, I told him, I arrived at noon. I told him the day before, if he's not here by 1:30, I'm out of here. At 1:20, he comes out and tells me, okay, he'll be here in a half hour. And I said, oh, that's great. I won't be. I told you, if it's not here by 1:30, I'm out of here. And I literally walked out. And I know that my credibility soared because no undercover cop is going to walk away from 17 kilos of cocaine that's going to be 20 minutes late. I mean, it just doesn't even make sense. And my cover team had no idea that I had tickets to the Angels game, that I was taking my son to a ball game. So we put it off. We put it off that day. It ended up getting messed up the third day. Finally, on the fourth day, the deal happened. And I won't spoil the story for your listeners, but it turned out to be a rather huge on the fourth day, and actually hard to believe. I have to admit, I promise you it's a true story, but even after I wrote the chapter and reread it, it's like, I can't believe I did that. That was really stupid.
Now you're talking about the punching bag gloves, right?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Well, everybody, yeah, there is this little thing about boxing gloves. And if you want to know what it is, you have to get the book and read it. Because when I read that, I couldn't help but laugh. I thought, boy, you have some chutzpah. So, Yeah, this is such a great book, Bob. It really is. And gosh, I wish we had more time. I should have you come back for another half hour after a couple days or something, so we can just talk more about it, because, you know, I know you have to go right now. But I wanted to let other people know, where can they get the book? Do you have a website, or can they just get it at Amazon?
Yeah, Amazon.com is a great place, BarnesandNoble.com. It's in, I believe it's in most major bookstores. I mean, I know it's in Barnes & Noble. I know it's in Borders, Books A Million, Bookstar. I think most of the bookstores are carrying it, but get it on Amazon.com.
Yeah, all right. Now, everybody, this is, like I said, we're talking to Bob Hamer, who is the author of The Last Undercover, The True Story of an FBI Agent's Dangerous Dance with Evil. And let me tell you a couple other things about the book. It's been endorsed by Oliver North. This is what he says. He says, in this riveting, sometimes shocking account of his undercover work with the FBI, Bob Hamer vividly describes how he confronted evil with brains, bravery, and well-founded faith. The Last Undercover is the inspiring story of a real American hero, and I would concur with that. And then there's also other great endorsements on here. So if you want a copy, email me at stacyharp@gmail.com, and if I have any left, I will email you back, get your address, and send you out a copy. All right, so until next time, remember, we're here for the good guys, exposing the bad guys. And we'll talk to you again next time right here on our Active Christian Media podcast, the best podcast in the world. Okay, well, maybe not. But it is definitely fun to listen to, you gotta admit that. All right, until next time, everybody, have a great day. Visit activechristianmedia.com.